Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you, explains it in a way that's easier to understand. This season, we're tackling the cost of learning. The creation of schools in every town for every child dates back to before the Revolutionary War. In 1647, Massachusetts became the first to establish a right to an education. The use of taxes, including property taxes, quickly followed and was adopted by many colonies and later states. But that seemingly just and simple decision to use local taxes to educate children has had very long-term impacts and created a system that many feel has grown out of control. Joining us now to discuss a little more about the history of education funding in the United States and where it's heading in the near future is Martin Lukin, Director of Fiscal Policy and Analysis at EdChoice, a nonprofit organization focused on K-12 education choice. Welcome to All Sides, Marty.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Before we dive in, I do want to say that EdChoice, where Marty works, is not affiliated with Ohio's EdChoice voucher program. Same name, not the same thing. Okay.
That's right.
That's right.
That's a common confusion.
All right. So to pick up where I just left off, so since the founding of this country, educating children has been a priority. When did the federal government decide it was going to be a state-by-state responsibility?
Yeah, so, I mean, if we look at the early 1900s, we see that Wisconsin became the first state to basically create a state income tax, and that innovation spread quickly. And then other states followed suit, where by the 30s and the 40s, you had states begin to introduce sales taxes, as well as throughout the period. And so these new state revenue streams start to supplement the old property tax system. So before this, it really was, a local supported enterprise. And so today we still have property taxes, as the foundation of local funding, but state income and sales tax are also important pieces of the puzzle. And so from that time, states started to become more involved.
And historically speaking, this idea of common schools, and every child being educated, some of the schools a long time ago had religious affiliations, right? But it was just the idea of educating every child. Dating back to like the colonial times, there were a lot of religious schools, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, back to the colonial times, there were a lot of religious schools. And it was really, I think around the 1800s when you started to have the common school movement and common schools started to come on the map, it really did look pretty different than what we might think of today. So at that time, the day in a school usually started with a prayer, started with a hymn and Bible readings. There definitely were religious roots. But specifically, it was rooted in, Protestant teachings. When people back then said that a school was sectarian, they didn't mean that it was all, they weren't referring to all religions. They were talking about one Protestant denomination over another. And so that's a distinction, that's, a big shift from today's usage.
Yeah. And then you jumped to the 1900s and you talked about Wisconsin being the first state to use income taxes to pay for schools. This idea of using taxes, income taxes, property taxes, do we just say it's all Wisconsin's fault then?
Yes, we could blame Wisconsin, but when you started to see some state support, but state involvement actually really took took shape starting in the 70s, where we had basically three waves of litigation. So in the early 70s, there were there was litigation that was focused on equal protection clauses of the U.S. Constitution. And in these cases, advocates were arguing that funding should be equal, or at least so heavily on the wealth of a school district, which it did up to that time. And so, but that effort hit a wall when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that school funding isn't a federal constitutional right. And so it's with the second wave of litigation, what we call equity lawsuits, this is where states really got involved. Cases happened in the 70s and 80s, where families and advocates went to the state courts and they were arguing that their state's funding formulas were unfairly disadvantaging poor districts. And so a lot of states that responded by basically overhauling their systems, and they started sending more money, more state money, to lower wealth districts. And this is where we start to see these equalization funding formulas start to take shape. And so this is really where the state funding took a bigger role in equalizing dollars across school districts.
Mm. And the federal government's role did keep expanding, whether it's funded properly or not is the debate for the ages. But there's all kinds of things after the lawsuits that you mentioned. There's Nation at Risk in 1983, No Child Left Behind in 2001, Every Student Succeeds in 2015. So talk to me about where the federal government is playing a role, even with decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court, but the states are the ones that have to pay for it, right?
Yeah, it's really interesting. The federal government does have a lot of influence in K-12, yet their funding, the federal funding, represents roughly 7 to 10% of a total funding for public K-12 systems on average. And so the federal government really does have a small share of the funding pie. But with these initiatives that you explained, where with NCLB and and before that you had the Nation at Risk, which started the standards movement, that really I think increased influence for the federal government and K-12 policy.
This is Untangled, the Cost of Learning from All Sides in WOSU. We're talking with Martin Lukin, Director of Fiscal Policy and Analysis at EdChoice, a nonprofit organization focused on K-12 education choice. I mentioned earlier, but I wanted to say again, that EdChoice, where Marty works, is not affiliated with Ohio's EdChoice voucher program. But I did want to spend a few minutes with you diving into this idea of EdChoice, because your group helps policymakers on both sides of the aisle understand how school choice programs impact state and local budgets. Are you seeing more and more states leaning toward more school choice, but perhaps there's less consensus on how to pay for it?
Yeah, we are definitely seeing a lot of momentum and appetite increasingly for educational choice programs. Currently, there are about 75 programs that are serving 1.3 million students in 35 states, as well as Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico. Now, these programs have grown slowly over time, but since COVID happened, that was really an inflection point. And from that time, we started to see several states either introduce universal eligibility programs, which are open to all or most K-12 students in the state, or expand currently existing programs. Because before that, programs tended to mostly cater to and serve specific targeted populations, such as students with disabilities or low-income students. And there were some a few programs that were also open to middle-income families as well. But we definitely have seen a sharp increase in states passing programs, and as well as in the number of students who are, you know, eligible for these programs and participating in them.
Yeah. But back to that paying for it part, there's a lot of people who work in public education and care about public education who do not want to see public money going to some of these school choice programs. So I guess, do you find the debate is solely around private school vouchers? Because my understanding is school choice is not just a voucher, correct?
That's right. When you're talking about private choice programs, a voucher is one type of program. That's where you can use, you receive a voucher and you can use part of the public funding that would be directed to that child's public school. But you can reuse that to access and pay for private school tuition. A tax credit scholarship is another type of program. More recently, ESAs or education savings accounts. These programs are becoming really popular because not only does it allow families to access private school, but it really does unbundle education and allow families to access a whole menu of different educational options, such as, you know, these could be things like tutoring or therapies if you have a child with special needs, online curricula, extracurricular activities, and things like that. And then, of course, that's private choice. And there's also all sorts of other options as well. Not only do you have district schools, but you have public charter schools, magnet schools, open open enrollment policies as well. So choice can mean all these things and broadly, but as far as our work, we're focused on private school or private educational choice.
Okay, so your organization focuses more on private schools, because I was wondering if you consider, like, the public school here, Columbus City Schools, runs a lottery program that allows students to go to specialized schools within the district. It's an expensive program to run, but a lot of parents feel it's worth it for the choice. So do you consider that a school choice program if it's a public school lottery program?
Yeah, that could be part of a choice program. From our point of view, we want all options on the table. We just, our mission is to get every child in wherever, you know, is the best fit for them. So that could be the district school or a magnet school or a charter school or whatnot, but it could also be homeschool, private school, and, you know, learning pods or whatever it might be.
This idea of letting any kid go anywhere, it's expensive, though. I mean, and sometimes the parents can pay for it and sometimes they can't. Vouchers are a big issue here in Ohio. We're spending a lot of money on vouchers and allowing everyone to access them. So what kind of debate do you hear across the country about the money being spent?
Yeah, it does sound expensive, right? But when you consider that the public K-12 system, which taxpayers are already paying for, that is the dominant, overwhelming main provider of education. And so even, you know, when you look at suburbs and wealthy areas where taxpayers are paying for those public schools, roughly 10% of students are enrolled outside of the public school system. And so, but this idea, though, I think at a fundamental level, that dollars should follow the child, that is, I think, a really powerful mechanism to educate a child, because it's based on the belief that a parent knows their child best. And so you're empowering the parent to direct those dollars to where they deem the best fit for their child. And that might be a district school or another public school, but that could also be something outside of the public school system.
And we've also found that this is not a party issue. I know plenty of conservatives and plenty of liberals who send their kids to schools that are not their neighborhood public school. What's the most common reason you hear from parents as to why they begin to explore choice and not going to the local neighborhood school?
Yeah, so there are actually a whole list of options of reasons why parents are exploring options. Parents want schools for a variety of reasons. They might care about academics, but some care about safety, and that's really important. Some parents care about values and moral teachings. Some may care about sports. Some may, choose based on location. But there's all sorts of different reasons that parents are choosing. And so that goes to this idea that it's really hard or impossible to build a one-size-fits-all system. You really need a system rather than top-down. You need to build it from the bottom up and try to create a system that invites different models and ways of educating a child into, the K-12 landscape. So that's really the key, the goal. We expanding options, expanding diversity of options so that families have, a better chance of finding something that will work for them.
What do you say to people who say that all of these the private school vouchers, having these charter schools, it's taking money away from the public school system. So therefore, the public school system is having trouble succeeding because the money is being spread around. Do you disagree with that?
Yeah, I mean, look, the evidence does not support that idea. When you look at research on the issue, and when you look at how these choice, when choice comes onto the radar, how does it impact students who remain in public schools? And this is one of the few areas where there's a strong consensus in the research, where almost every study indicates that public school students who remain actually improve in academic learning. They make gains in academic learning. And not only that, there was a study by an economist at Northwestern University, David Figlio, and others on his team, where they also looked at what happens when a state expands a program in terms of funding and eligibility. And again, they found that the public school students actually improve in learning. But also you see lower absenteeism, and you see lower suspension rates as well. So you have better behavioral outcomes too. So this is, a policy where competition works, and, this is a tide that lifts all boats.
We've been talking with Martin Lucan, Director of Fiscal Policy and Analysis at EdChoice, a nonprofit organization focused on K-12 education choice. Marty, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk with an education advocate who's going to tell us a little Ohio history of education funding and who wants to see public funds stay with public schools. That's when All Sides and Untangled, The Cost of Learning, continues on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you, explains it in a way that's easier to understand. This season, we're tackling the cost of learning. The United States Constitution does not explicitly mention education. Instead, the 10th Amendment gives states the power to provide public education. And while there is no federal constitutional right to an education, the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause has been used to ensure education is provided equally. But equality and equity are not the same thing, and the debate over the fairest way to pay for a child's education continues. Susan Kaser is an education specialist for the League of Women Voters. She's also spent decades working as a public education and public school funding advocate. Welcome to All Sides, Susan.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about the history of K-12 public education funding from your perspective here in Ohio. It's not always been so complicated and contentious. Is that right?
That's right. I think we need to remember that a system of a publicly funded system of education that welcomes all, that's non-sectarian and nonpartisan, is deeply rooted in the history of our country and in our state. While it's not in the federal constitution, every one of Ohio's or of the country's 50 states have in their constitution the obligation of state government to provide for a system of public schools. So the founding fathers understood that if we were going to succeed in this experiment of democracy, every voter needed to be educated, which means everybody deserves an education. And they assumed that the only way to make sure that would happen is to provide it by government with public funds and include everyone. So that goes back, Ohio was part of the Northwest Territory. So starting in 1787, the Congress called for public funding of public schools. The Ohio Constitution, adopted in 1851, created this thorough and efficient clause, which basically says that the state is required to create a thorough and efficient system of public schools. So this is not about an individual right. It is about the common good. And that is the history of this, and its democratic principles and purposes are really what drive my interest in it, and are why, for up until really 1965, public funds only went to public schools. In 1965 is when Ohio passed the legislation that made school districts responsible for transporting private school students. So residents of this state have always had the right to use a private school, and private schools preceded public schools in our country's history. But public schools were determined to be what makes democracy work, and they are also democratic because they bring everybody together in a common purpose in a community. So that's where our roots are very, very deep. And they are built on very strong principles, and they have been very well thought out, protecting the taxpayers' rights and students. So we're concerned about making sure there's quality everywhere. And in a system of public schools, that means that we have our state is built on this partnership between the local community and the state for funding schools and for running them. Mm-hmm. And so every school district, every student who attends whatever school district they attend, that school district needs to have comparable, sufficient funds to provide a quality education. That's what a thorough and efficient system does.
I read a bit about the history of the school funding formula that Ohio schools used. The first one was approved in 1935. That formula was used in the 40s and 50s. And basically, to summarize it, the state paid half of everything. But then by the 60s, that state portion had decreased to about 30%. And then if we jump ahead to the 90s, because that's when things really got interesting, school districts started to question how much money the state was giving out, not just to the entire system, but each individual school district. So could you tell me a little bit what happened with education funding in Ohio in the 90s, whenever districts started questioning? Yeah.
So I started working in public education in the state in 1981. And back then, the big concern was, were we adequately funding our system of public schools? In 1992, a coalition of 550 school districts sued the state of Ohio for not adequately funding public education. And that was called the DeRolf case. It was based in Perry County. Nathan DeRolf was the lead, whatever, was the person whose name was on the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And in 1997, the Ohio Supreme Court, after, you know, having decisions appealed, found that, in fact, the plaintiffs were right and the system was not constitutional. And they mandated that the legislature fix this. And the primary concern in that lawsuit was that we were relying too heavily on property taxes. And as you know, the property wealth of every community is quite different. And the ability of the income level in every community is quite different. So if your community has low property values and you're relying on property taxes to fund your schools, it's going to be a much heavier burden in a low value, low wealth district than it is in a high. So education opportunities will vary widely, and the burden for taxpayers will vary widely, depending on your community. And so that's really what's at stake. And when there have been several efforts since the DeRolf case to make some improvement, and one of the big outcomes was a much better funding of the facilities in our state. Mm-hmm. But for most of the time since that decision, there's essentially the legislature has ignored this requirement and has continued to rely heavily on property taxes and not to take up its fair share of the cost. So this partnership in funding is really important. But now at this point, local taxpayers, as the state continues to ignore the DeRolf case, it just pushes the burden more and more to the local community, which therefore exacerbates the kind of inequality of opportunity and ultimately is leading to underfunding of schools.
This is Untangled from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, Untangled the Cost of Learning. We're talking with Susan Kaser, an education specialist for the League of Women Voters. And there's that distinction there, like equality is everybody gets the same thing. Everyone gets the same math book, the same basketball, the same desks and chairs. But equity is giving everyone what they need personally, taking into account a specific student's needs. So that's where that's the rub in paying for it, because there are certain districts that require more money for equity as opposed to equality.
I'd like to speak to that. There's the individual case of equity, and then there's the community case for equity. Mm-hmm. So what we're really talking about is that you have equity in tax burden across communities. And one of the wonders of a really good school funding plan, which we had in the Fair School Funding Plan, which began to be catched in 2016, was that it really did a better job of both accounting for what it really costs to educate kids and also to account for the differences in a community's capacity to contribute its share towards the shared cost of funding kids. And that's the fundamental of a good funding system, is that it really accounts for the differences in a local community. And, you know, we have 610 school districts. Our communities are really different. The size of a school district can be 2 miles by 2 miles or 30 miles by 30 miles. You can have a high concentration of poor children. You can have a high concentration of children with disabilities. So coming up with a funding system that accounts for all those differences and then make sure that no matter which school district you attend, there's sufficient funding, that's where you get to equity. Mm-hmm. Another part of what's involved in that formula is taking into consideration the unique needs of each individual. So we have extra weighting, extra funding for certain categories of kids. So I'm really pleased that that Ohio really did make progress when Bob Kupp and John Patterson formulated the bipartisan Fair School Funding Plan. And it was it was introduced in 2019 in that budget cycle, but did not pass. But in 2021, what the budget that was passed then, they introduced a three-step phase-in of this new formula that really did look at the base cost and how you would divide that fairly across each school district, accounting for the capacity of that school district. What's great is that it kicked in for two of the three cycles. But in the last budget that was approved this June, this school budget is a step backwards. So my community, which should have gained about $7 million with the full funding, lost $700,000 in this budget. So school districts, and we're not alone, school districts across the state are receiving less money than they did in the last biennium because of the failure to really implement a plan that was really going to bring some level of adequacy to the state contribution and equity in the sharing of responsibility. So it's been a very disappointing moment. That concerns me. And
one thing that I hear often is that we're spending more and more on public education, even without fully funding the Fair School Funding Plan. We are spending more on public education than we did, 15, 20 years ago. And the outcomes are not overly better. So does the money actually help in the public school system? Does the money help if we still have kids falling behind or not graduating?
Of course it does. Well, first of all, we are spending more, but the cost of doing business is going up. And as you know, it's going up even more. The basis for the Fair School Funding Plan was that it's an input-based program. So you think about the actual cost of doing business. And what they failed to do in this most recent is to update the input to reflect the actual cost. So school districts have been underfunded over time, even in keeping up with the basic spending that they provide. So that is, you could really question, there is no question that resources make it possible to educate children, and you cannot do that without resources. And state resources are really important to lifting the burden from local communities so they can tolerate keeping up their contribution. And so we can have an opportunity for equal opportunity. I think it's very questionable the measures and metrics we're using for saying kids are not keeping up. I don't think that that's accurate. And I think it's a really important to note that in this last budget, there was an increase in spending, but there was a much bigger increase in spending on privatized education options. So public schools that serve 1.6 million kids received $45 million less in increase than the private schools that serve 180,000 kids. So keeping up is really real and costs. You have to do basic things if you're going to meet the needs of children. And I would have to say, in this environment where there's much greater concerns for security, where there are mental health issues, where we're still recovering from COVID, where children are really having to deal with a very complicated world. We've got to make sure there's a robust set of opportunities in every school that helps really serve every child.
Before we run out of time, I did want to talk about education choice for a minute. What charter schools are. That's what these private vouchers that you mentioned are. There are people out there who say that, we give public schools more money, the outcomes don't improve, so we need competition. That's what the private schools do. What do you say to this increase in the state budget and this increase in private school vouchers and giving kids and their parents a choice?
Well, the choice has always been there. It's legal in Ohio to use any of those education options, first of all. Second of all, it isn't really always their choice. These schools are selective. They choose who gets the money by who they admit. And an individual choice is something we value in our society, but so is the common good. And from my point of view, public funds are there to support the common good, and that is all of us benefit from having an educated society and voters. And we need to make sure there is education available everywhere. And we know private education is not widely available. It's mostly in six counties. Most of the money in this state is going to six counties. Choice is sort of a lovely idea, but it isn't really a reality.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to say thank you to Susan Kaser, education specialist for the League of Women Voters. She's also spent decades working as a public education and public school funding advocate. Susan, thank you for your time today.
Thanks a lot for taking on this issue.
Coming up, we're going to learn a little bit more about where Ohio and its school funding methods fit into the national picture. That is when Untangled from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. Three times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Juravich, and this is Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you, explains it in a way that's easier to understand. This season, we're tackling the cost of learning. How we pay for a child's education has been debated for decades. How much should state government pay? How much should local property taxes cover? The Ohio Supreme Court ruled in 1997 that there was too much reliance on local property taxes, which made funding inequitable across the state. School districts in wealthy suburbs with more expensive homes have more money than poor urban and rural areas. And state lawmakers have been working to fix this for years with varying and conflicting measures of success. Howard Fleeter is an economist and research consultant for the Ohio Education Policy Institute, a nonprofit research group that prepares reports for education interests. Howard has worked on school funding and state and local tax policy issues in Ohio for more than 30 years. Thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
So I wanted to start with what I just mentioned in my introduction, that ever since the state school funding system was ruled unconstitutional, people have been working to fix it. I've been told that the Fair School Funding Plan from 2021 was the closest we've ever gotten to fixing it. Do you agree?
Right. It is. So yes and no. So it's a complicated question. And so, you know, I heard what your previous guest had just said. She gave a very good summary of, you know, the history of DeRolf and whatnot. And to summarize the ruling, there were three main parts of the DeRolf ruling. One of them you mentioned in your introduction, which was the over-reliance on the local property tax, and that really gets at the equity issue because we've got wealthy and poor school districts, and that's a problem. The next issue was, at the time, the state contributed almost no money whatsoever to the construction of school facilities, and, you know, if you're having trouble raising money for operating, you're going to have trouble raising money to repair and build new buildings, and the state has largely resolved that issue by creating a school construction fund, and we've spent over $11 billion on that, and that's a literally concrete improvement that we've made in education. The third thing is the adequacy issue. If the over-reliance on the property tax is the equity issue, the other part of the ruling was the adequacy issue, where there was a flaw in the state funding formula at the time of the DeRolf decision, which was the parameters that were in the formula that determined how much money a typical student got, and then a student who has additional needs, like a low-income student or a student with disabilities, a career tech student, those dollar amounts were all chosen by the state legislature. And so, you know, people think, well, we elect the state legislature to make decisions like that, right? But, you know, because of the thorough and efficient clause, there's a higher standard for K-12 education. And the court ruled that the state could not just be determining the dollar amount for the base cost and then, by extension, the additional cost for other students just by making a budgetary consideration of how much money they were willing to spend. The DeRolf lawsuit clearly directed the state, and they quoted a report that I wrote for Governor Voinovich when they did this. So my name is in the DeRolf decision for all of eternity. But they, you know, the what they said was that the state has to, that the parameters in the formula have to be based on a methodology which determines the cost of educating different kinds of students in the state. Mm-hmm. And so the Cupp-Patterson Fair School Funding Plan does that. And then Susie explained it takes an inputs-based approach. We've had other approaches which did it. The first approach we had immediately after the DeRolf decision was an outcomes-based approach that looked at, you know, what success, you know, what districts that were getting good outcomes were spending, and then saying if they can spend that much, then that becomes a benchmark for what other, you know, for how you set the funding for everybody else. So that's an outcomes-based approach to do it. We kind of morphed that over, you know, years into kind of a combined hybrid approach. Mm-hmm. We had something that looked very similar to the Fair School Funding Plan for 2 years under when Ted Strickland was governor, mm-hmm. which was called the evidence-based model, which was also a very detailed inputs-based approach. So over the first 13 years after the DeRolf decision, depending on how you count, we had three or four different methods that the state used mm-hmm. to get at the adequacy issue. And, you know, for one reason or another, there were none of them were ever quite fully funded. But, you know, what happened, I think it was, you know, largely the aftermath of the recession, and it was Ted Strickland losing the election in 2010 and John Kasich becoming governor. He threw out the evidence-based model. But we went back to, from 2014 through 2021, we went back to the exact same system of determining the formula amounts that we had before the DeRolf decision, which was the state determining the amounts based on what they chose to allocate as opposed to what it cost. So the Cupp-Patterson Fair School Funding Plan, when it was implemented in FY22, went back to an objective method for determining this. And you know, you had a guest on your first show that I think completely mischaracterized that plan as saying it was all about getting more funding for education. That could not be more incorrect. It was about going back to what the court explicitly said the state needed to do with the school funding formula, which is determine the parameters based on what it costs, not what the state is willing to put into the bucket. And, you know, as Susie said, you know, the first several years of this were going better than it is this biennium. And the reason for that is that the state share has been declining precipitously the last 3 years, right? And
right.
So we are down to, you know, last year the state share was 38.4% of the base cost. It's forecast by LSC to be 35% this year, and next year it's going to be 32%. And I've gone back to 1999, which was the first year of the response to the DeRolf decision. We have never had a year where the state share of the base cost has been less than 40% until last year.
Hmm.
And that is directly because of decisions that the legislature has made to not update the inputs in the formula, which is what drives the adequacy calculation. Hmm. But they've continued to update the parameters that drive the state and local share. And when you only update one side of the formula, it's going to fall out of balance. And the balance has been to lower the state share and then raise the local share.
Yeah. Last week, I talked with Bruce Baker. He's with the University of Miami. He does a right. big national study on fairness and adequacy right. of school funding. Now, he would say his numbers were older because that's just how he does his numbers. That he's behind because data lags and he's using all 50 states, right? But at that time, he said that Ohio was doing okay. The state funding contribution compared to other states, Ohio ranked 21st, which is above the middle. If he does that study again, is that going to change?
I don't know what numbers he's looking at because
yeah.
I've got numbers that are right in front of me right now that I can tell you using the U.S. Census Bureau data. In 2002, Ohio ranked 35th in the state share of school funding, and we were about 5 percentage points below the national average. However, by FY23, which is the most current year for that mm-hmm. data, Ohio has fallen to 45th mm. on that list, and that we are now 11.2% below the state average. So
is this just an example of you can get numbers to say what you want?
I don't think the U.S. Census data is yeah. saying what anybody wants. I'm just looking at the percentages that they publish, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I would be curious as to where Bruce has got his numbers that show us you know, in the middle. I mean, this is, I'm just looking at the state share of funding. Bruce mm-hmm. may be looking at the total state and local share of funding, and mm-hmm. that would make more sense to me
yeah.
because Ohio, not just with schools, but with other services, we provide more services at the local level
I think that's
other
it. Yes.
than other states do. So, mm-hmm. you know, I started looking at this data in 1990 and when I was a professor at OSU, and Ohio typically ranks in about around the top third in local taxes, around the bottom third in state taxes. And then when you put them together, we're typically in the middle.
Yeah, what that's what he was saying. So yeah. he was comparing it to other states where other states, you know, don't
right.
have, they have different ways of using property taxes
right.
and that kind of thing.
So we're 20 something in terms of state plus local. But the issue lately has been that state share has gone down and the local share has been going up in response. Now we've got a property tax problem in the state for that reason, along with some other reasons as well. So
this is Untangled from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how Ohio pays for a child's education with Howard Fleeter, an economist and research consultant for the Ohio Education Policy Institute. Your group has a report with much more recent numbers, as recent as it gets, related to property taxes. And you found that Ohio has the eighth highest property tax rate in the nation. How much of that goes to schools? Were you looking at all of it?
So typically about two-thirds of property taxes in Ohio go to public schools.
Okay.
And then the rest of it go to all the other services that we fund. So it's city services, township services. Those are basic services, police, fire. We also deliver and fund a lot of human services at the local level than in most other states are funded by the state. So we have, if you think about your tax bill, it will show a developmental disabilities mm-hmm. levy on it. It will show an alcohol, drug addiction, mental health levy on it. Senior services, children's services, some places have mental health and public health levies on it. We fund a lot of human services at the local level. So, you know, again, just because of our emphasis on local control, we always are going to be, you know, in 10 to 15th or so in local taxes, and we're generally around 35th in state taxes. Lately, our state ranking has fallen to, we're 42nd in state taxes, and our property tax ranking has gone up now that we're in the top 10. So, you know, the balance we have, you know, the imbalance we have has gotten even more imbalanced in the last several years. And that's partly because of state revenue trends, which then turn into state funding trends. But we also have some specific issues with property taxes in Ohio that have caused the problems that we're facing today.
So you wrote in your study that Ohio is at a property tax tipping point. The state, is the answer that the state needs to be paying more? The state cut, you know, the overall tax. I mean, they want state taxes lower. So the property taxes are going to have to make it up.
So I think the answer in our report, if you look at it, is that we're suggesting that there needs to be a balanced solution to the problem. And, you know, we've cite several forces that have occurred over the last 20 years or so that have got us to the point where we are right now. And, you know, you can call it a tipping point. Some people, if you look at the constitutional amendment to abolish the property tax, some people are saying it's a property tax revolt. But we have had over the last 20 plus years, the share of property taxes that have been paid by homeowners and farmers has increased by 20 percentage points, from 47.5% to 67.5%. And the business share has gone down from over 50% to about 30%. And that is largely because of some state tax policy decisions that were made that eliminated entirely one business tax and reduced significantly the public utility property tax. And those policy decisions were done for defensible
business interests.
But they were done also for good tax policy reasons. The problem is that in Ohio, those were local taxes. And so it's putting more pressure on schools and other local governments. And for every dollar that you're raising now, more of it is coming from homeowners than it was 20 or 25 years ago. And so, you know, homeowners are getting squeezed by that. You know, we have a very restrictive property tax limitation called House Bill 920 that is unlike anything that any other state has, that this is what allows most voted levies do not generate any more money after your house goes up from reappraisal. You know, they don't generate any more money overall for the local government than they did before, which is a way to control people's property taxes. And nobody, no other state has a provision that works like that. There is a safety valve that, you know, that is being exploited right now. Exploited is probably the wrong term. For school districts, you can't go below 20 effective mills because that is the minimum millage that the legislature has explained you need to have in place in order to qualify for state aid, and it's called the 20 mill floor. Once you're at the 20 mill floor, House Bill 920 doesn't reduce people's taxes. And so we now have two-thirds of the school districts in the state at that 20 mill floor. Back in 2012, we had about 100 districts in the state at the 20 mill floor. And a lot of that is, you know, the main reason we've got so many districts at the 20 mill floor is property values have been going up the last several years at a rate we haven't seen since the 70s. And so we've driven these districts down. We're raising people's taxes.
Yeah.
The state share is going down. It's kind of a perfect storm.
We've been talking with Howard Fleeter, an economist and research consultant for the Ohio Education Policy Institute. Thank you for your time. And this is Untangled, the Cost of Learning. Be sure to subscribe to the Untangled podcast so you don't miss an episode. For All Sides and Untangled, I'm Amy Jurevich.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom takes you around the state, connecting you to news and neighbors from all over Ohio. Our reporting team puts thousands of miles on our cars, traveling to cities, towns, and villages far and wide to root out news you won't hear anywhere else, reporting on statewide challenges and highlighting stories of hope and inspiration. Listen weekday mornings at 5:45 and 7:45 during Morning Edition.